one more tribute to the greatest generation today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Many of those who survived the Allied invasion of Normandy don't want us to call them heroes. This is how one D-Day veteran remembers what he and thousands of others set out to do 75 years ago today.
We knew what job we had to do, and we wanted to do it and not let anybody down.
They definitely did not let anybody down. Also today, terror grips residents of Sudan's capital, Khartoum, as armed militias roam the streets.
So it's a huge contingency of these armed men just walking around wreaking havoc on a killing spree.
Plus, remember Tetris? The computer game was a Soviet export, and it turns 35 today. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Military planes flying in a special missing man formation over the beaches of Normandy, France today, in honor of soldiers who died on D-Day 75 years ago. President Trump and dignitaries from the UK, France, and Canada, among others, were there. The World's Orla Barry followed all the day ceremonies for us. Most memorable, she says, were the hundreds of veterans who served and survived the invasion.
This is probably the most poignant aspect of all of today's events, is because you do sense that this is the last time that we'll hear the voices of this generation. Mm. So there was one gentleman, Frank Bow, he's 95 years of age and he was a signalman with the Royal Navy, and he was speaking at the Commonwealth War Grave Ceremony in Bayeux in France, and he said there are some memories of the day that he can never get out of his mind.
My most abiding memory of that day is of seeing our boys. We've been talking to them minutes before, but they were cut down with machine gun fire. They fall into the water, floating face down, and we couldn't get them out. We couldn't help them.
Yeah, carries it with him his whole life.
Yeah, because so many people have talked about this kind of heroism that they had to, and that leap that they took from the landing craft into the water. But listen to this chap, Arthur Hampson, and he's very matter-of-fact about what they did.
To me, a hero is somebody who does something he doesn't have to do, puts himself in danger in order to do somebody else a good turn. We were there, we knew what job we had to do, and we wanted to do it and not let anybody down.
It really struck me, Orla, the clips that I've seen today, amazing the way almost every vet insisted they are not heroes. It's their fallen comrades, they said, almost to a man, who are the heroes. It was so moving. Donald Trump was also at Omaha Beach, where the U.S. servicemen who died were remembered, right?
Yeah, exactly. He was there with Melania and Mr. Macron, the French president, and his wife. They estimate around 9,400 servicemen, U.S. servicemen, and some women actually are buried there. So President Trump, he paid tribute to them, to some of those sitting on the stage alongside him, and also to some of those who died on D-Day.
The GIs who boarded the landing craft that morning knew that they carried on their shoulders not just the pack of a soldier, but the fate of the world.
It's kind of interesting to hear Trump thinking about the fate of the whole world. as you mentioned, Orla, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was also with Trump. I gather he had some kind of pointed words for the U.S. president.
Yeah, it was interesting. D-Day, it's seen as one of these great symbols of transatlantic cooperation between the nations. And during his speech, Macron, he thanked the U.S. troops for their courage. But he also talked about the loyalty between nations.
L'alliance des peuples libres.
And during his speech, he kept on turning and looking at Donald Trump. And at one point, he was saying, you know, the United States of America is never greater than when it shows its loyalty, loyalty to the universal values of the founding fathers defended. And he went on to say, this is, you know, we shall never cease to perpetuate the alliance of free peoples. This is what the victorious sides did when they created the United Nations and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
L'organisation du traité de l'Atlantique Nord.
And as we know, Trump has often described NATO as obsolete. He didn't respond during President Macron's comments. He gave a kind of an awkward smile, but he said little more.
Yeah, interesting moment to make that point. The World's Orla Barry, thanks for wrapping this up for us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
veterans who served during D-Day and are still with us. They're in their 90s now. And as we just heard from Orla, some of them attended the ceremonies today, despite their age. Reporter Jake Saganaro met with one of the last surviving D-Day veterans.
On Omaha Beach in Normandy, a lone piece of concrete juts out of the sand. It's known as Ray's Rock, named after the former U.S. Army medic Ray Lambert. At 98 years old, Ray Lambert is a star on Omaha Beach. People want to shake the D-Day veteran's hand. People like Eric Morrow from Bowie, Maryland.
Sir, from one veteran to another, thanks very much for your service and everything you did.
You're very welcome, sir.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, too.
Thanks.
Last year, the town above the beach, Colville-sur-Mer, which is home to the American Cemetery, put a plaque on the rock with Lambert's name and the names of his fellow medics who landed here on June 6, 1944. Lambert and his men used the concrete mound to shield wounded soldiers from German gunfire 75 years ago during the onslaught of the D-Day landings.
I know that they are being remembered. Those guys are my age today, so they have many of them gone, of course. Their names are here permanently now and will ever be, and it makes me feel good.
Lambert grew up in rural Alabama. He and his brother Bill signed up for the Army in 1940. They went through two landings before D-Day, North Africa in 1942 and Sicily the following year. Ray Lambert was wounded in both assaults and awarded the Silver Star for bravery. Then the brothers faced the Omaha Beach bloodbath together.
He had the machine gun bullets on the ramp like hail, and so we knew when the ramp went down that we would be, the machine gun bullets would come in and kill some of our guys. When I went off the boat, something went through my right elbow, and it shattered the elbow. And so I went underwater to get away from machine gun bullets.
Ray made it to the beach, but he was even more exposed to German gunfire as he tried to treat wounded comrades.
And there was nothing for them, nothing to get them behind. So I was looking around, and I happened to see this rock. And I told my men that we'd have to try to get those guys behind this rock.
Ray was wounded again, this time in the leg, and later woke up next to his brother in a military hospital. Even though they lived through three invasions together, Ray says he and his brother Bill didn't talk about the war much when it was over.
I realized that if I didn't tell these stories about my men, that no, they couldn't do it, and I felt that my responsibility and obligation to them to try to talk to people and tell people about the war and what they did.
Bill Lambert died in 2010, and Ray says this will be his last trip to Normandy. But before he goes home to North Carolina, he wants to have one more glass of Calvados, the region's signature apple brandy.
That'll either cure me or kill me. I'm not sure which one or the other.
The number of locals here who remember the D-Day landings are dwindling, too. Up the coast behind Juneau Beach, Marguerite and Remy Cassignol serve glasses of Calvados at their home in Saint-Aubin-sur-Mer. Marguerite was 17 when the Allies landed. She'd lived under German occupation for 4 years. When explosions in the distance woke her up, her father told her to go back to bed. But around 3 in the morning, she says, the noise became unbearable. My father told us we had to go. The invasion had begun. The family took cover in a trench they had dug, then in a stable with neighbors. Today at 92, Cassignol still gets choked up when she talks about what she saw at Juneau Beach just after combat ended. We stopped at the wall, she says. There were Canadians. There were bodies lined up. There was one he didn't have a face anymore. You cannot forget that. Since that day, Cassignol says she doesn't like going to the beaches, even though she lives just steps away. For the world, Jake Saganaro, Saint-Aubin-sur-Mer, Normandy.
Trevor Hill is not a Normandy veteran, but he does have an incredible D-Day story. Hill was 18 years old at the time and working as a radio engineer for the BBC in London. On June 6, 1944, he was handed a package that contained one of the greatest secrets of the war, a recording that announced the Allied invasion. Hill told the BBC what he remembers about that day.
I was coming off night shift, and the message I got was, "Oh, Hill, go and get the news studio ready, and then go outside and wait on the balcony, and a vehicle will be arriving with a recording." The vehicle arrived, and I was handed this package. The vehicle had written on it AFRS, Armed Forces Radio Service. So I took the package to the studio, unpacked it. It was a 78 disc, and I put it on the turntable to take level. And I just heard this voice say,
People of Western Europe, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. This landing is part of the concerted United Nations plan for the liberation of Europe, made in conjunction with our great Russian allies. I have this message for all of you. Although the initial assault may not have been made in your own country, the hour of your liberation is approaching.
And then I was told that a BBC announcer would be coming in to announce the event.
Hill recognized the voice on the record, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander Europe. So Hill knew this was something big.
There were security people, and they came and told me I was not to speak to anybody. I wasn't allowed to ring my mother and say my night shift had been delayed and I wouldn't be home for a while. I wasn't allowed to speak to any other BBC colleague or anybody else because I had heard D-Day announced by General Eisenhower nearly 4 hours before it happened.
Finally, the BBC announcer arrived and the broadcast could begin.
He makes the announcement that here is General Dwight D. Eisenhower.
To members of resistance movements, whether led by nationals or by outside leaders, I say, follow the instructions you have received. To patriots who are not members of organized resistance groups, I say, continue your passive resistance, but do not needlessly endanger your lives. Wait until I give you the signal to rise and strike the enemy.
When I heard the recording, I thought, wow, you know, after all the waiting, thank goodness we're now going to retaliate. We're going to take some action. It's not going to be all the Germans bombing England. Perhaps, you know, we can stop it.
After the broadcast, the secret was out to the world, and Hill could finally go home for the day. As for the actual 78 RPM record, Hill tried to give it to a BBC librarian.
And the librarian on duty that night said to me, "Oh, thank you, Hill, but this doesn't happen to be a BBC recording." So I thought, oh, well, if the BBC don't want it, I'll take it home. So Eisenhower's announcement of D-Day was taken and put in my dad's attic.
That disc stayed in the attic for nearly a decade. Eventually, the Beeb did take the recording into its library. I mean, how could they not? It's been stored safely there ever since. On this anniversary of D-Day, you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Venezuela has been muddling through a political crisis for months. Some would say years, even. We were stunned in January when an opposition leader took on President Nicolas Maduro, the handpicked successor of the deceased Hugo Chavez, and then last month there was an attempted coup. Dozens of countries backed it, and the Venezuelan military seemed to sign on. Here on The World, we covered the attempted coup every day and were glued to social media for updates. But the news struck one of our former producers, Ruxandra Guidi, even deeper.
Violent street battles that broke out in Venezuela today.
Thousands of people responded to the call by the opposition to...
This is the moment a military truck rammed into a group of protesters in Caracas.
I think it was about 5 a.m. My phone kept buzzing next to my bed, and it was a friend of mine who had just been sent a video of National Guard in Venezuela stopping traffic in all the major freeways, and I realized that there was a coup underway.
And my heart just stopped because my father's still there. He still lives in Caracas. I was born in Caracas in 1976. By the time I was three, my parents divorced and I was raised by my mom. But I saw my dad on the weekends. And growing up, my dad was the, you know, the popular hippie who was always going to parties. And his friends at the time looked up to Fidel Castro in Cuba. Back in those years, in the 70s, you were either looking to move to the U.S. or you wanted to stay in Venezuela and had this, like, dream of socialism that Cuba had established for the rest of the region.
Compañeros y compañeras.
And I grew up hearing the speeches by Castro, like we might listen to Dr. King today. You know, like, we just would listen to that on the BBC in Spanish, you know, for leisure, for entertainment. So this was something that I didn't question in those years. Then in 1990, my mom got a fellowship offer in the States. I was 14 years old at the time, and we ended up staying in the U.S. You know, I kept in touch with my dad, so we wrote each other these long handwritten letters. But after about 5 years in the States, we started talking to each other less and less. By 98, I was finishing college, and there were elections in Venezuela, and Hugo Chavez won.
Venezuela tiene su hora, y es que llegó la hora del pueblo.
My dad transferred all his adoration for Fidel Castro to Hugo Chavez, and he had faith that he would fix the country, he would do away with inequality. But, you know, I was wary of how Chavez came from the military and that he seemed to want to identify his enemies wherever he went. So I started to become disillusioned pretty quickly. Meanwhile, my father was going in the opposite direction and he was consumed by Chavez. And I found it difficult for him to relate in any way to what my life was like here in the U.S. He would call it the empire. And this is what Chavez himself would use to refer to the United States. And before long, we had very little to talk about. We found ourselves arguing about everything. And around those years, around the mid-2000s, we became estranged. And we only really spoke around our birthdays or holidays. 5 years ago, I moved to Quito, Ecuador, because I wanted to see how Hugo Chavez's revolution and its influence were playing out in the rest of South America. And while I was living in Ecuador with a young kid, my father's only grandkid, he reached out to me one day and he asked to meet her. And I remember one of the first things we did after we picked him up at the airport is we went to the supermarket. And my father started to weep when we walked through the supermarket because he hadn't seen that much food in a couple of years. It was very intense. You know, he'd lost a lot of weight. He was considerably older. And he was enamored with my daughter. So we just simply got back into our relationship where we'd left off. You know, looking back on it, I don't really know how or why things got so bad between my dad and me. There was a politics, of course, but there were a lot of other issues. Like, I felt abandoned by him. I was upset that he didn't do more to support me and my mom financially and emotionally. And there was this huge guilt that I felt, you know, about having left Venezuela, about having become Americanized. Almost like betraying him and his principles. It's as if the changes, the radical changes that went on in Venezuelan society were so closely linked in time to the changes that went on in my life, my own coming of age, my shifting relationship with my dad. It's hard for me to blame, of course, Chavez or the revolution for that, but it's definitely all tied together in my mind, in my consciousness. So these days, I don't really argue at all with my father anymore. I see my role more as the person that wants to hear him out. He spends most of his days in his room listening to the state TV channel and RT, that's Russia Today, in Spanish, and they're just broadcasting Maduro speeches, Fidel Castro speeches, spreading the message that the revolution is still alive, that the reason why there's food shortages is because of the economic war that the U.S. is waging against Venezuela. And these are often lies fabricated by the regime. But as it turns out, on the day of the attempted coup, my dad explained to me how he knew this was coming. They'd been saying so on the state TV channel, and he's confident that this will happen again. And, you know, I have to say, I found myself agreeing with him. I think he's right. I think this is going to happen again. And I just hope that he has the strength to live through this. And I hope I'll see him again.
Ruxandra Guidi reflecting on politics and family. She told her story to The World, Sarah Birnbaum and Ian Koss. The music you heard there was by an ensemble of Latin American musicians featuring Venezuelan pianist Gabriela Montero. I'm Marco Werman, and coming up, we meet volunteers saving lives in the Arizona desert. They drop off food and water along routes traveled by migrants crossing into the U.S. from Mexico.
Since the 3rd of January, 36 people have died in the desert.
But for volunteers, there can be legal consequences. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Arab Spring came late to Sudan, and now it seems to have stalled. Democracy activists in Khartoum say they're still in shock. On Monday, paramilitary forces cleared out their main protest camp. They beat demonstrators and killed more than 100 people. In response, the African Union today suspended Sudan from the organization. The perpetrators of the violence are known as the Rapid Support Forces, or Janjaweed. That is the same militia that brought violence and mayhem to the western Sudanese province of Darfur more than a decade ago. Now Sudanese authorities have all but shut down the internet. But earlier today, my colleague Carol Hills managed to reach Khartoum resident Dalia Abdel Monim. Abdel Monim told Carol that in recent days, the Janjaweed militia have taken control of parts of the capital.
The roads are empty. We could see members of the Janjaweed roaming the streets in my neighborhood, in my area. There were reports of huge clashes between protesters and the Janjaweed forces, or the rapid deployment forces.
Describe the rapid support forces, the former Janjaweed. When you saw them, what were they doing?
They're heavily, heavily armed. Some of them looked like they had rocket launchers and...
We were not able to get a clear phone line back to Khartoum, but Abdel Monim sent us several voice memos describing the militia she's seen on the streets of her neighborhood.
The ones that move on foot, they carry whips and they carry sticks or truncheons. These sticks, they're fitted with like electrical pods, so when they hit you with it, you get electrocuted. These are state-of-the-art weapons that this force, this militia of thugs is using and has been using on Darfur, and they're now turned and they're using it on us in the capital.
Many Khartoum neighborhoods, according to Abdel Monim, look like a war zone.
Blockades are literally on every street, whether it's a main road or it's a side street or a neighborhood street. And then you also see the black marks left from tire burning. You see the broken glass, which is from the Molotovs that some protesters have used against the Janjaweed.
Abdelmonim says democracy activists like her are not backing down. They're hardening their resolve.
We're more determined that we're not going to let this slide, that we will not allow anyone to hijack our revolution, be it third parties who have an interest in the regime staying in place, be it the military council that has no, that is obviously not interested in giving up power nor sharing power with the civilian government. So we're more determined than ever, and we're going to push through. There's a civil disobedience plan, mass civil disobedience plan starting from Sunday. Hopefully that will cripple the government systems and the government entities. And most likely we'll also go back to the tactics that we used when we first went out protesting in December, which is basically small pockets of protest coming out in the neighborhoods, barricades, galvanizing the people to come back. And I think once that shock wears off, we'll see a completely different scenario unfolding in front of our eyes. We're not giving up. We've come too far to give up now, and this is our revolution. This is our fight. And all those who've died haven't died in vain.
Tomorrow we get the long view of Sudan and its people.
They are desperate, desperate that their story be heard by the world.
Scholar Eric Reeves says the attack this week on Sudan's pro-democracy protesters is a bad sign for what could come next. The rise of the Janjaweed, a.k.a. the Rapid Support Forces, is creating a split in Sudan's military.
There's tremendous dissatisfaction, especially in the middle ranks, the majors, the colonels, the lieutenants, who would stand up to the Rapid Support Forces, and they would have superior firepower.
That divide could lead Sudan back into civil war and another humanitarian crisis, which could be bad news for the whole region.
This is a pivotal country in northeastern Africa, and it stretches from the Mediterranean to the equator, practically. If there is civil war in Sudan, there will be a flood of Sudanese migrants to the European continent. It will be very bloody, very nasty, and could be quite protracted.
The crisis in Sudan, that conversation tomorrow here on The World. Scott Warren is a humanitarian aid volunteer in Arizona. He's also a criminal in the eyes of prosecutors. Warren is on trial this week in Tucson for felony charges of transporting and harboring undocumented migrants. If convicted, he could get up to 20 years in prison. Activists like Warren work throughout the southwestern desert, leaving food and water for migrants crossing through the harsh conditions there. Reporter Claire Mullen has a story.
We start early in the morning in Ajo, Arizona, just north of Mexico. I'm with John Orlowski and Victor Garcia. They're preparing their backpacks for a hike deep into the Sonoran Desert.
2, 4, 6. We take cans of beans that have pop-top lids. We also take trail snacks, granola bars, power bars, high-energy food that we can leave and that's non-perishable.
That's Orlowski. He's been doing this for years. Garcia then stuffs plastic jugs of water into his pack.
4 total, but it's a lot of weight.
And it feels much heavier by the end of the day.
We then begin a trek into one of the deadliest stretches of the border. When people die out here, it's often because of dehydration.
Since the 3rd of January, in the Ajo area, 36 human remains have been found. 36 people have died in the desert near and around Ajo.
Since the year 2000, more than 3,000 human remains of migrants crossing over have been found along the Arizona-Mexico border. It's around 80 degrees when we set off, and it hits 95 by noon. Orlowski works with a group called the Ajo Samaritans. It's one that Scott Warren works with, too. Warren is a 36-year-old geographer who's on trial in Tucson. The government is charging him with felonies for harboring and conspiring to transport two undocumented people. Warren says he was giving them medical attention and never intended to break the law. Volunteers like Orlowski are closely following Warren's trial, but they continue to do their volunteer work. And they make sure not to get lost out in the desert themselves.
In the desert, it's super easy to get lost. What we're holding is a Garmin GPS device, so we have marked waypoints, we know where we're going, and we'll follow the little blue dot to get there.
We head to one of the water drops about a mile in. At one point, the search function on the GPS stops working.
I don't know.
Where we're going?
Where we're going.
Okay. So we navigate using Orlowski's knowledge of the nearby mountains.
So we're going between those two peaks this way.
Great. The path takes us straight into a thicket. Yeah, this is some intense bushwhacking. Oh, you okay?
Yeah, it's just...
We push through, find the trail, and the first water drop. But there's a surprise.
There's a drop?
Oh, are those bees?
Yeah. Bees love water, just like everything else.
Orlowski also notes what's left and what's missing at the drop. A lot is still here. There's a bucket full of snacks, some clean socks, along with gallons of water.
That would indicate there's only been a couple people that have come by here, based on the usage. And there's with really high ATV traffic around here.
It's ATV traffic from Border Patrol.
This is likely not a common path anymore.
Orlowski says volunteers are trying to keep up with water demand along new routes. By noon, we're back in Ajo.
It was a beautiful day in the desert.
Orlowski is only among the few people in Ajo who spend their Saturdays like this. I head over to talk with Kenneth Fries, an 89-year-old military veteran who's lived here for 20 years. He's also following the Scott Warren trial. Fries and Warren used to be on the same community council. And Fries doesn't agree with what the volunteers do in the desert.
I don't care if they give water to them. They probably need it. I'd probably give them water, too, if they needed it. But the underlying thing here is we're encouraging them. We're encouraging the illegals to violate our laws.
Fries hopes that Warren's case will set an example for others.
If he gets convicted and he has to serve time, that should be an incentive to the people here to obey the law.
So far, humanitarian aid groups say they'll continue working in the desert, whatever the trial's outcome. But some people in Ajo do worry about the chilling effect. Jose Castillo is from Ajo. Some people call him the town's historian.
I grew up in the desert. That was my playground.
He's 80 now, but he used to take water out into the desert, too.
You live in the desert, you get to learn at an early age to help people.
If Scott Warren loses his case, Castillo thinks people might be scared to help migrants.
If he loses, I'd be afraid to share a glass of water with you. Like I said, that's not humanity. It's not humanity, I don't think.
For the world, I'm Claire Mullen, Ajo, Arizona.
The prosecution of Scott Warren for helping migrants in the U.S. has echoes of something similar in Europe. The refugee crisis there spiked in 2015, and since then, at least 250 volunteers and aid workers have been arrested, charged, or investigated for helping migrants. That's according to an investigation by the UK-based news organization Open Democracy. Tanya Karas from the World's Immigration Desk has been digging into the details. First of all, how is this a crime, at least according to Europe?
So it's different across all different countries, but in general, we're seeing two primary ways that people are being charged with crimes. They're either charged with facilitating irregular migration, or they're charged with terrorism or organized crime offenses. And this is all for doing things as simple as giving a migrant food or water or a ride, or it could be something significantly greater, like actually rescuing them at sea. And you have all kinds of ordinary people getting caught up in this. You could have, you know, an elderly person who might offer a spare bedroom in their home. You even had the case where a teenager was writing criticism against his government for their what he perceived as anti-migrant sentiment, and they're all being charged with various things.
So do you have an example of just one person who's been charged and what they actually did?
There was one case involving a French olive farmer, and he drove a couple of migrants across the border from Italy in his truck, and he originally faced a five-year prison sentence and 30,000 euro fine for doing that. And he ended up with a 3,000 euro fine. But a lot of the volunteers and aid workers perceive this as having a chilling effect on their work and for anybody, really, any individual, to help migrants.
How widespread is this, Tanya? Like, what countries are we talking about here?
It's pretty widespread. Most of the cases, though, are taking place in seven different countries, and that's Italy, Greece, France, the UK, Germany, Denmark, and Spain. But I would say Italy has been the most active in pursuing these kinds of cases, particularly since they get so many instances of people coming from Libya and North Africa on boats. And so Italy's main target has been trying to stop the NGOs from doing their search and rescue work in the Mediterranean Sea, because they tend to rescue very large groups of migrants and bring them into Italian ports. And so what Italy has done is to devise all kinds of laws and to sort of go after different groups like Doctors Without Borders, another group called Sea Watch, for performing these search and rescues, which are really life-saving, but the Italian government and other governments perceive them as essentially what they call taxis of the sea, because sometimes migrants know that there will be somebody who can rescue them. And so in the eyes of somebody like Italy's Deputy Prime Minister, Matteo Salvini, he might think that the reason why people are coming is because they know that they're going to be rescued. So he might perceive the rescue effort as being essentially, you know, working in tandem with smugglers on the other side in North Africa.
So it sounds like these prosecutions are basically going after Good Samaritans. How successful are the prosecutions? Are people getting convicted and sentenced?
They've been really mixed. For the most part, a lot of people have gotten off with having to pay fines, or the charges have been downgraded. But the point, though, is this fear that, you know, people are afraid to operate. People are afraid to continue their life-saving work. And, you know, for a major group like Doctors Without Borders, they have, you know, more than 40,000 employees all around the world, they might be able to fight something like this. But definitely for the individuals or the smaller actors, this can really put them out of commission.
Tanya Karas from the World's Immigration Desk, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Climate change is having a big impact on human health and mental health specifically. That's the bottom line of a new report from 27 European Academies of Science. But exactly how something as big as the climate crisis affects mental health is a question that Helen Berry wrestles with every day. She's a psychiatric epidemiologist and a professor of climate change and mental health at the University of Sydney in Australia. Professor, it seems almost intuitive that climate change could affect our mental health, but is there actual evidence that that's true?
So the short answer is yes, of course. And the long answer is no, it's incredibly difficult to do this kind of work, partly because climate systems themselves are extremely complex, and partly because mental health is also extremely complex, and bringing those together makes a very huge and difficult puzzle. But I think it's really important to apply some common sense here, which is what you implied in your question, and also to understand how we can go about approaching this problem so we can eventually get the scientific answers that we want.
That makes sense. And I gather that the research suggests that this can play out on at least two levels, the emotional impacts of specific events and trends, as well as the emotional weight of the bigger picture. So what do we know?
I think what we need to do is go back to first principles. We're in the process of destroying the very natural systems that we rely on for our survival. And anything that we do that threatens our survival is inherently terrifying. And that's one of the first pathways from climate change to mental health impacts. And you see this, I think, particularly in the kids' protests that we've seen around the world, and how very terrified children are about the planet that they're inheriting and what the grown-ups around them are doing to it and failing to do. And the more vulnerable people are, the more prone they are to be victims of that particular mental health pathway.
Yeah, give me an example of that, because the report does focus specifically on marginalized people, that the most affected in terms of mental health.
Mm. So, for example, we had in Australia in the summer of 2011-12 two cyclones and huge floods in Queensland in the tropical north. And the people who were living in poor regions and those who also were socioeconomically disadvantaged in their own right were much more likely to be hit by the flood itself. But what we also found in that study was that if you were flooded and you happen to be a socioeconomically disadvantaged person, the effect on your mental health was at least twice as bad as it would have been. And we see that all around the world. We see it with drought. We see it with heat.
And Helen, if you're not instantly affected by specific events, as you were just describing, and you're just thinking about the future of the planet, do mental health consequences from climate change suddenly become kind of like a middle class concern?
So if you'd asked me that question a couple of years ago, I would have said thinking about climate change doesn't in and of itself cause mental health problems for individuals. But I think in the last year or so, with the really catastrophic indicators that we're getting of what climate change may mean in practice to real people in real lives, I think that's starting to change. And I think we're seeing it at a group level as opposed to at an individual level in some categories of people who are the most vulnerable.
Helen, you're based in Australia, and your official title there at the University of Sydney is Professor of Climate Change and Mental Health. I have to wonder if you're not like the very first person in the world to have such a position.
I am, and as far as I know, I'm still the only one. But Australia is in the unusual situation of being very vulnerable to climate change and also being a wealthy country that has some capacity to invest in research. So we've kind of taken that job on, if you like.
Helen, how does understanding the dynamics between mental health and climate change actually help people cope?
So what we need to have is the best mental health possible to help us adapt, because one of the things that mental health problems does is reduce people's capacity to cope and adapt. So we don't want that right at the moment where we've got a massive crisis on our hands. So we need to keep people as healthy as possible in every way, especially mentally. And we need people to have tools and ways to adapt.
Helen Berry is a professor of climate change and mental health at the University of Sydney. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, not to ignore climate change, but time now for a distraction. Recognize this jingle? You might have spent countless hours with that tune at your computer playing Tetris. The game was created on this date in 1984. The world's Brandy Fullwood pieces together the story.
Alexei Pajitnov created the first playable version of Tetris. He was a young researcher at the Moscow Academy of Science, and he was bored. So during work, he started building a digital puzzle game. He's a big fan of puzzles, and he based this one on Pentominoes. It's a game that involves making a rectangle with five puzzle pieces. In Tetris, the pieces fall from above, and the goal is to make them fit nicely together. Of course, when Alexei got his game up and running, his coworkers wanted to play too. So the game went from one floppy disk to another, from computer to computer all over Moscow. Eventually, the Russian government noticed and decided that Tetris was a huge disruption in the workplace, so it blocked the game on state-owned computers. But it didn't take long for Alexei's game to make its way to Hungary. A British software manufacturer there pounced on the idea and bought the rights from the Russian government. The computer version of Tetris continued to spread, and soon it found its way beyond the office floppy disk.
They said it wasn't humanly possible, but now you can have all the power and excitement of Nintendo right in the palm of your hand. Introducing Game Boy. It's portable, it's in stereo, and its games are interchangeable. Plus, Game Boy comes with the outrageous new game, Tetris.
As for myself, I was introduced to Tetris Christmas 2003. Yeah, I was a third grader, and video games from the 80s were making a comeback. Pac-Man, Galaga, Tetris. I played it for hours. It's the 35th birthday of Tetris, so what better way to celebrate than by distracting my coworkers?
Loading 3, 2, 1.
Can you ever win, or does it just keep going like so fast that you eventually no human could process it?
Like, my heart is racing.
Wait. I don't know.
Oh God, that was dumb. That was really dumb. Back in the day, it'd
yeah.
get harder, right?
I mean, you're only on level 2.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's gonna get worse. Like, I was in here level 9, and they just started falling.
Wait, you were playing earlier?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, they're starting to fall.
Yeah, they're
though.
Starting to go quick.
Oh! Boom!
No!
The panic starts to set in.
There's no victory, death, in Tetris. Oh my goodness.
87,000! Somebody call my parents.
Do you want to try again?
Yes.
Okay, really, just one more game. For the world, I'm Brandy Fullwood.
Sorry, Brandy, game over. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.